Good morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. This is Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, April the 11th, 2018. We'll start with the news section. Bad blood. Hawaii commissioners tore themselves apart over a failed golf course. Toward the end of a marathon session of the Wake County Board of Commissioners on November 6th, Greg Ford turned to his colleague Matt Calabria and offered some words of gratitude. They would soon be on opposite sides of a contentious 4-3 vote to acquire the defunct Crooked Creek Golf Course in Fuquay Varina and turn it into a park. Ford ended up in the minority, voting no. Regardless of the turnout, Ford told him, your persistence and diligence has been beyond admirable, and you've been beyond fair in being transparent and sharing with us updates and including us in the process along the way. I really appreciate that. What a difference 5 months makes. On Friday, Ford joined Chairman Jessica Holmes and Commissioner James West in a blistering letter condemning their four fellow commissioners, Calabria, Sig Hutchinson, John Burns, and Irv Portman, over a planned campaign event at the site of the proposed park on April 15th, which they claimed borders on unethical conduct. Several citizens brought this event to our attention and expressed concerns about the appearance of a pay-to-play arrangement, or at the very least, the perception of a legitimate conflict of interest. Far from praising Calabria and his colleagues' fairness, the letter slammed them for a lack of informed information shared with us. This is not in keeping with the values of transparency and good government that we have embraced as public servants. You could chalk this up to politicians being politicians, using any hint of impropriety to tarnish their rivals. And in many other places, such a play would be commonplace, especially with the May 8th primaries on the horizon. But this is the Wake County Board of Commissioners, a body entirely controlled by mostly like-minded, mild-mannered Democrats who have, since taking power a little more than 3 years ago, prided themselves on technocratic policymaking and a pervasive sense of comedy. Portman called the letter a case of sour grapes. A good board does its homework and makes its decisions and moves on, he said. It's amateur, in my opinion. Ford, however, says that's not it at all. It's really about transparency. His faction decided to write the letter, he said, after learning that the other faction tried to sneak through a final vote on purchasing the park on the consent agenda, without debate and without anyone realizing what was happening. Now, this is disputed. Then, he continues, they learned of this event where they believed those residents whose property values would benefit most from the park would fate the commissioners who voted for it and lavish them with campaign contributions. This, too, is disputed. Even if they don't think there's anything wrong, Ford says, we're saying the optics are bad. We're saying don't go. To understand the increasingly bitter fracas over Crooked Creek, you have to understand that it's about more than just a park. To a large degree, it's about the very question animating this year's Democratic primaries. Have Wake County commissioners lived up to their campaign promises to adequately fund public schools? Last year's budget critics point out only granted the Wake system $21 million of a requested $45 million in new funding, leaving out things like additional school counselors. This amount was $5 million more than the county manager had recommended, but the school system was left with a $24 million hole. The year before, the school board asked for $35 million in new funding, but received only $24 million. Only in 2015, the first year after the Democratic takeover, did the commission give the school board nearly everything it wanted. When the school board unveiled its request in April of 2017, Portman complained that it was a record request, adding, "The more we fund, it seems like the more the request is." That didn't sit well with school advocates. It's no coincidence that the five commissioners who voted for the budget, the four who voted for the Crooked Creek Project, plus West, drew primary challengers, while Ford and Holmes didn't. Also no coincidence, Ford is a former principal, and Holmes is an attorney for the North Carolina Association of Educators. In September, Dean Debnam, the president of the Raleigh-based public policy polling and a big Democratic funder, commissioned a survey that would only be described as a shot across the bow. In it, he pitted an unnamed woman who supports fully funding the schools against the male commissioners who didn't. The unnamed woman trounced her male competitors by about 50 percentage points. Around the same time, another big Democratic donor, Ann Campbell, the co-founder of Campbell Alliance and a board member of Waste Zero in Raleigh, began emailing Hutchinson, Burns, Portman, and Calabria with subject lines such as "Second Chance" and "Third Chance," according to the records obtained by the Indy. The county commissioner's underfunding of the school's budget request had been a major disappointment, not just for the school board or the teachers or parents, but for the entire community that has demonstrated repeatedly that it values public education, Campbell wrote, asking the county to find more money for schools. "You were widely supported by progressive groups and voters who assisted you to be elected, in large part based on your stated belief in the need to provide adequate funding to public education." She closed from a line from the musical Hamilton, "History has its eyes on you." Burns replied by paraphrasing a Hamilton line of his own, "Winning is easy, governing is harder." To which Campbell retorted, "The point of my earlier email, John, is centered on the current state of the sausage-making in Wake County, in a county with a lower tax rate than most other metropolitan areas in North Carolina. We could find improvements to achieve outstanding public education if the Wake County commissioners would simply revisit their funding priorities. It's up to you and your colleagues to make the trade-offs, navigate the sausage-making, and find a way to make it happen. Since I appreciate the fact that you appear to like one of my favorite musicals, I'll leave you with one more quote to consider, which is Hamilton's advice to Burr when he was trying to be diplomatic and preferring to wait for it versus carrying a banner for courageous causes. If you stand for nothing, Burr, what'll you fall for?" The rift deepened from there. By November, Campbell was accusing Burns of intentionally obfuscating and ducking the point in order to burnish fiscal credentials for a future run for a higher office. Calabria, of trying to find a compromise on the point to please everyone a little bit, but particular local constituents a lot, in order to maintain appeal for a future run for a higher office. Portman, of refusing to even focus on the point that being raised and insisting on talking about a different point, and Hutchinson of missing the point. Campbell backed all of these men when they ran in 2014. She gave $6,000 to Calabria, $3,750 to Hutchinson, a donation matched by her husband John, $5,000 to Byrne, and $2,500 to Portman when he ran in 2016, also matched by John. Debnam was similarly generous, $5,000 to Calabria, $5,000 to Burns, $2,500 to Hutchinson. This year has been a different story. Campbell and her husband and Debnam and his wife maxed out to Burns' opponent, cumulatively accounting for $20,800 of a reported $28,860 in donations as of the latest finance report filed February the 14th. In February, Campbell solidified her change of heart and formed a political action committee called Women Awake, PAC, Technically, in state records, Woman Awake PAC, owing to a typo, Director Paula Wolf says, to elect progressive women to local office in North Carolina, beginning in Wake County. The PAC, whose board includes Shesha Debnam, Dean's wife, and the manager of Debnam Property Management, LLC, alongside longtime educating promptly endorsed female challengers to Portman, Burns, and Calabria. Men are running against Hutchinson and West. The idea behind the PAC is simple. Campbell says in an email to the Indy, the demographics of the Board of Commissioners, 6 men, 1 woman, don't represent the county's makeup, and these men in particular have failed to honor their promises to our teachers, our children, and our families. Clearly, we need more progressive women to better reflect the values and priorities of our community on the Wake County Board of Commissioners. It's unclear what kind of support Women Awake will offer its endorsed candidates. Susan Evans, a former school board member challenging Portman, Vicki Adamson, a school board's advocate running against Burns, and Linda Brown, a former county commissioner taking on Calabria. Campbell notes that PACs, like individuals, aren't limited in the amount of direct contributions they can make to candidates. But Portman is trying to raise alarms about the prospect of a large independent expenditure to take out the current county board. Indeed, the local rumor mill is rife with speculation that this new PAC would inject significant cash into the campaign's waning days, similar to what Debnam did toward the end of the 2015 Raleigh City Council election with the Drunk Downtown ad campaign. We have a great board that is doing good work, Portman says in an email. 76% of all property tax goes to education. Tax increases 4 years in a row, unprecedented, but not enough for those affluent mega donors. This is important and way out of bounds. In an interview, he adds, the reality is they're using the woman card. They're using that as a guise for another fight, referring to the school funding dispute. Irv Portman may be feeling threatened because some of our supporters were formerly supporters of his when he campaigned in his last election on the platform of supporting public education, Campbell counters. In his prior campaign, when he was receiving significant support from some of our donors, he didn't voice any concerns about any undue influence of donors to his campaign. Since winning his last election, Irv Portman has been viewed by many supporters of public education as a contentious voice who questioned not only the priorities of the school board, but even at times their motives. He was, however, been willing to dig up unbudgeted funds for an unplanned park that was requested by local homeowners around a failed golf course. Which brings us back to Crooked Creek. Just as it seemed that the sore feelings over the school funding fight had begun to die down, the battle over Crooked Creek poured gasoline on the embers. Everyone agreed that the project had merit. The site is 164 acres. It would be home to a much-needed school if adjacent to protected wetlands is being backed by nonprofits and would eventually connect to greenways. Even the project's critics found things to like. But it was a question of priorities. Ahead of the vote in November, Holmes and West pointed out that every dollar spent retrofitting the golf course, not just the $4.5 million purchase price, but up to the $20 million that might eventually be spending developing it into a park, was a dollar that wouldn't be spent on schools or affordable housing. The county staff, meanwhile, identified other projects it deemed more urgent and recommended that commissioners vote against the purchase. But some 200 park supporters had shown up at that meeting, many clad in green shirts that read, "Park, please." They'd bombarded commissioners with emails in the days before, arguing that this was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and if the county dithered, the land could turn into a residential development. led by Calabria, who lives about a mile and a half away from the proposed park. A bare majority of commissioners agreed to support what one source says was known among county staff as Matt's baby. Their support didn't yet come with money. 9 conditions had to be met, and then another vote had to be held before the county would buy the property. In a March 34th post at the South Wake Park Project Facebook page, Ron Nowatchkick, a leader of the Crooked Creek Park effort, said that he believed the acquisition vote would happen on May 21st. That was news to the board's anti-park faction, who drove suspicion that the pro-park commissioners were coordinating with park supporters behind their backs. For 4 days later, at an informed agenda meeting with Holmes, Portman, and Hutchinson, the county does not record minutes for these meetings, there was a brief talk of placing the Crooked Creek project on the consent agenda because the commission had already voted on it once. But a county attorney quickly rejected that idea. At least, that's Hutchinson's version. Ford tells it differently. He wasn't there, but he heard about it from Holmes, who declined to comment on the meeting for this story. In Ford's telling, Hutchinson not only lobbied to get the purchase through on the consent agenda, but tried to do so under a generic title that wouldn't arouse ire. It was only after Holmes asked questions that it was pulled from the consent agenda. After that, according to the anti-park side, Hutchinson asked that the county punt on the park until after the primary. According to the pro-park side, however, Hutchinson asked to push back the vote because the conditions hadn't yet been met. Why take up a touching subject on a sensitive time if it didn't really matter? Or as Burns put it, there's no need to throw a politically divisive bomb into April if we can't purchase the property in April. The truth is, the park probably wouldn't have been a big deal if the county had given the school board what it wanted last year. It was the comparison of those two decisions that became political fodder. Months after telling the school board they couldn't find funds, here commissioners were signing off on a multi-million-dollar park project. That's what the primary challengers want to highlight. Their priorities are just different than mine and what the communities are, says Adamson. Calabria believes bailing out Crooked Creek Golf Course is more important than funding the Wake County Public School System for nurses, counselors, or social workers, Brown wrote in her Indy candidate questionnaire. Brown, who did not return a phone call, also argues that Calabria should have recused himself because the park will boost his property values. Friday's missive from Ford, West, and Holmes poured salt in the wound. I'm still trying to wrap my head around it, Calabria told the Indies a few hours after the letter's release. These three commissioners do not appear to have previously raised any of the objections they have raised. I was disappointed, Burns echoed. He bristled at the letter's insinuation. I consider my ethical reputation the most important thing I have as an attorney. I cannot, I will not, sacrifice that. The four Crooked Creek supporters forcefully pushed back against their opponents, not only just the campaign event, but also about the park and the school funding vote. For instance, they argue it might look bad to say that the commissioners only gave the school board half of what it asked for in new funding, but that's misleading. The new funding only accounts for a small portion of the school system's total request. Factor in the whole thing, and they actually gave the school board 97% of what it asked for. They also note, and the primary challengers don't argue the point, that the previous Republican-led board left the county behind education funding, and they've spent the last 3 years trying to catch up. Indeed, the board has raised property taxes every year since the Democrats took over. The county's contributions to the school system, Burns pointed out, has increased by nearly a third in that time frame, and teacher pay is up 41%. The criticism, then, is that they haven't caught up quickly enough. But Portman worries that if they raise taxes too high, That would give Republicans a window to make a comeback. Then, where would the schools be? As for the park, they defend their votes on the merits, arguing that it will be vital for quality of life in the fast-growing section of southern Wake County. This is a great project, says Hutchinson. It is no more a golf course than the American Tobacco Trail is a railroad. Calabria disputes the notion that the Crooked Creek neighbors get special treatment and chafes at the suggestion that he should be recused himself. The park won't directly benefit him, he said, and in my event, it will serve the greater good, which is his view, obligated him to vote. Ashley Manstead, an administrator on the South Wake Park Project Facebook page, says her group's interactions with the county belie any notion of favoritism. We were met with preconceived notions from some of the commissioners, and possibly the staff as well, she writes in an email. It seems that they were not given to even give this proposal fair consideration because it was not in keeping with their particular focus or priorities. Only a large, remarkable effort by residents of southern Wake County to consider the future and plan for the rapid growth of the area made a park a reality. Manstead also says the letter was misleading, because intentionally so. The public invitation to the event was posted on the SWPP page, which has thousands of followers, many of whom don't live in Crooked Creek. Therefore, it is probably false that Crooked Creek residents were the target recipients of the invite, which was the basis for Commissioner Holmes, Ford's, and West's serious accusations against their colleagues. In addition, this event was not intended to be a traditional fundraising event, as was unfortunately miscommunicated. This was an event for the sole purpose of inviting the commissioners who voted for the park out to thank them. The four commissioners say there's nothing unseemly about this event. It's just politics, meeting with supporters and trying to get them to the polls to support you. The candidates have not organized the event, Burns said, but we certainly support citizens getting actively engaged and offering political support to people they agree with. He adds, when you are talking about community meet and greets, the primary pitch is for volunteers and votes. Every meet and greet I went to involves checks, Ford deadpans. Mistrust abounds. Tensions that began brewing with the school funding debate and boiled over with the Crooked Creek debate threatened to tear the board asunder. I don't know, Calabria says when asked if the letter changed things. I think you're right that it has been an extremely collegial board up until this point. I would hate for the interpersonal things of differences exaggerated by outside political actors to influence the cohesion of the board. He pauses. But I really don't know. The next news article, policing in black and white. The DBT has reduced traffic stops and searches and pot arrests, but racial disparities persist. In 2013, the FADE Coalition, a collective of Durham organizations and individuals concerned about the way drug enforcement feeds mass incarceration, called out racial profiling in the Durham Police Department. FADE, which stands for Fostering Alternatives to Drug Enforcement, issued 5 recommendations with the aim of reducing racial disparity in policing, require officers to get written permission to conduct so-called consent searches, make marijuana the department's lowest enforcement priority, require periodic review of traffic stop data, strengthen the Civilian Police Review Board, and mandate race equality training for the department. 4.5 years later, with new policies and new police chief in place, the DPD has significantly reduced traffic stops and searches and marijuana-related arrests, but racial disparities still persist in both areas. There's been some progress on all 5 recommendations, says Nia Wilson, coordinator of Spirit House and a FADE member. But we don't ever just want to stop with some movement. We always want to be doing better, Wilson told the Durham Human Relations Commission last week. When FADE made its recommendations, tensions were high in the Bull City. Durham police had shot and killed two men, Jose Ocampo and Derek Walker, earlier that year. And that November, according to authorities, 17-year-old Jesus Huerta managed to shoot himself in the head while handcuffed in the back of a DPT patrol car. Community outrage over racially disparate policing prompted then-Mayor Bill Bell to ask the Human Relations Commission to investigate. The HRC, building off of FADE's request, presented its own list of 34 recommendations to the City Council. Most have been addressed. As for FADE's recommendations, three have been fully implemented: written consent, traffic records review, and race equity training. When it comes to making marijuana the agency's lowest law enforcement priority, the DPD has not exactly followed FADE's advice, although the number of drug violations issued is down by half since 2015. Even under former Chief Jose Lopez, marijuana wasn't considered an enforcement priority. In 2016, Chief C.J. Davis reinforced this by directing officers to cite, not detain, people for misdemeanor charges. The department has also been referring a growing number of marijuana cases to the Misdemeanor Diversion Program to keep them off of the offender's records. But there are quite a few exceptions to the citations directive. If the person had previous criminal charges other than non-impaired traffic offenses, was outstanding warrants, doesn't have a valid ID with them, or is facing accompanying charges. In cases where the only charges are for the misdemeanor possession of marijuana or paraphernalia, the people being charged are almost all black. According to city reports, there were 854 charges for misdemeanor possession of marijuana or paraphernalia in 2016, compared to 1,406 in 2013. The report only breaks down by race cases in which only those charges were filed. In 2015 and 2016, there were 144 such cases. In 2015, 80% of those charged were black. In 2016, it was 84%, although research shows no significant racial difference in those who use pot. Delvin Davis, a research analyst with Self-Help, told the HRC that in recent years, those charges have been concentrated in East Durham, a historically black part of the city. According to a 2015 Self-Help report, residents in Census Tract 10.01, the focus of the city's poverty reduction initiative, were three times more likely to be charged with misdemeanor marijuana possession than anywhere else in the city. Self-Help argued that such enforcement is counterproductive to the poverty reduction initiative because a conviction could charge up to $374 in court fines and fees and have collateral consequences for a person's employment and housing. Officers are choosing citation over arrest more often for pot offenses. The report for 2017, expected out this summer, could reveal even more citations in light of Davis's 2016 policy change. The number of traffic stops and vehicle searches has fallen drastically since October of 2014, when the DPT began requiring written permission for consent searches in which probable cause of a warrant aren't required. According to data presented to the HRC by Ian Mance, an attorney with the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, which operates OpenDataPolicing.com, the DPD stopped 14,000 fewer drivers in 2017 than it did in 2013, and black drivers accounted for about 60% of that reduction. Yet black drivers are still being disproportionately stopped and searched by the Durham police. According to Mance, Durham police were executing about 100 consent searches per month. Since the policy changed, that number has dropped to about 15. Over the past 5 years, black drivers have accounted for about 59% of drivers stopped by Durham police, while white drivers have made up about 27% and Hispanic drivers about 11%. Since 2008, the share of drivers searched who were black has hovered between 75 and 85%. About 38% of Durham's population is black. One of the animating reasons for the written consent policy was to reduce racial disparities, Mann said. It has not had that effect. The disparities remain. That said, I do think the policy has been effective, and it is a good policy. Jason Scheiss, a DPD data analyst, told council members last week that while traffic stops were down 22% from 2016, the demographics of the drivers stopped remained relatively unchanged, and black drivers were searched at a rate 2.8 times higher than that of white drivers, though officers find contraband in their cars at the same rate as white drivers. Councilmember Charlie Reese asked Davis about that disparity. We'd have to look closer at the data to see whether or not we have any other problems or other disparities that would say an officer might have a tendency to search one car more than another, Davis replied. Fade is asking the city to consider prohibiting stops for equipment and regulatory violations. According to Scheiss, these accounted for 26% of stops in 2017. According to Mance, 38% of black drivers were stopped for these reasons, compared with 25% of white drivers. Mance said that in other jurisdictions, prohibiting such stops was one of the few things that made a meaningful difference in racial disparities. The next news article... The New Left. They hate racists. They love assault rifles. Meet Redneck Revolt. The gathering, which took place at a picnic shelter along the French Broad River in July of 2017, was billed as Meet Your Local Redneck, and it functioned as a sort of coming out party. After months of firearms training and particularly successful efforts at community gardening, the Carolina Mountain Chapter of the Redneck Revolt was ready to unveil its program to allies in Asheville's far-left activist community. Wearing uniforms, red handkerchiefs around their necks, sleeveless shirts, tattoos, and looks ranging from shorn hair punk to bearded mountain man, they mingled easily with their left-wing friends, anti-capitalists from Industrial Workers of the World, Democratic Socialists of America interested in responsible handgun ownership, a representative from an LGBTQ self-defense outfit called Pink Pistols, and hardcore communists. They grilled chicken and gathered in a circle with banjos, fiddles, and guitars to sing Solidarity Forever. Redneck Revolt is a national network of anti-racist militias founded in July of 2016. Four chapters sprang up in North Carolina in 2017, although only one remains in the national network today. Assault-style rifles in hand, Carolina Mountain, with members from Asheville and Boone, played a key role in responding to the violent white supremacist Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville on August the 12th. The arrival at the July picnic of three members of the Asheville-based far-right militia American Pit Vipers didn't come entirely as a surprise. A couple redneck members had invited them after encountering them at a July 2nd impeachment rally in Rashville. Both sides were wary of each other, but eager to talk. Considering the deepening polarization and escalating tension surrounding Donald Trump's presidency, each worried that they could find themselves on opposite sides of a firefight. Carolina Mountain's hospitality set the tone for the impromptu summit. A handful of members leaped to their feet and greeted the right-wing militiamen with handshakes and wide grins. Seated across the picnic table from each other, 3-3, the conversation was friendly but intense, more like a spirited bar chat than a court-ordered mediation. One of the pit vipers wore an American flag patterned do-rag and a black T-shirt with Arabic-style lettering that ran, "Go screw yourself." He flashed a genial smile. One Carolina Mountain member from Boone broke away from the huddle to provide an elated report. "It's going well," he said. "We probably disagree on 95% of things, but they're about the community defense, and we're about community defense. The next time we see each other is going to be in the streets, and we're both going to be armed." Redneck Revolt's interest in firearms dates back to efforts by the anarchist-oriented Kansas Mutual Aid Network to disrupt the 2004 Republican National Convention in New York City, which attracted the attention of the FBI. Organizers, including future Redneck Revolt founder Dave Strano, decided to start training with legal firearms to signal that they wouldn't be intimidated. Strano hoped his example would encourage friends in far-left activity circles to undertake bolder modes of organizing. For several years, Strano and his associates cultivated the idea of class struggle, anti-racism, and Second Amendment advocacy that would form the basis of the Redneck Revolt. The network's founders adopted the term redneck in part to open doors in predominantly white communities, but it also meant as an intentional subversion in much the same way queer has been reclaimed by the LGBTQ community as a term of empowerment. Some chapters have found that the racial connotations of the word redneck impede cross-racial organizing. The Carolina Mountain chapter, for instance, ultimately swapped the Redneck Revolt moniker in favor of John Brown Gun Club, a reference to the anti-slavery zealot who tried to leave an armed slave revolt in 1859, explaining in a public statement that redneck did not reflect its membership and might be initially off-putting or possibly offensive to marginalized people they seek as allies. The emergence of Redneck Revolt in Phoenix in the summer of 2016 coincided with Trump's acceptance of the Republican nomination. It also followed years of anti-immigrant hostility in Arizona. Beyond the state's repressive SB 1070 law, which requires police to determine the legal status of anyone arrested or detained when there is reasonable suspicion that he or she is in the country illegally, right-wing militias had been showing up at mosques and harassing migrant border crossers. In the 21 months since the network's founding, Redneck Revolt chapters have participated in armed defense actions against white supremacists engaged in outreach to right-wing militias to discourage extremism and experimented with projects modeled after the survival programs of the Black Panthers and Young Patriots in the late 1960s. But the group has also come upon internal difficulties. In fall of 2017, a series of posts on an anonymous blog made an allegation, unsupported by evidence, of misconduct against Strano. In a letter threatening a lawsuit if the allegation was published, Strano denied it. Nonetheless, organizations in the anti-fascist movement have challenged Redneck Revolt's handling of the matter, and at least one Redneck Revolt chapter, Ross City in Portland, Oregon, withdrew as a result. Strano could not be reached for comment. Displeasure over the Indy's inquiry into the matter resulted in key members in North Carolina and Arizona withdrawing cooperation for this story. What most sets Redneck Revolt apart from the traditional left, of course, is its open carry tactic. Even among leftists who recognize the value of armed self-defense, brandishing assault rifles has been greeted with skepticism, although after Charlottesville, in which one Antifa demonstrator was killed by a white supremacist, some critics would grudgingly concede that the network's armed presence provided a bulwark of stability. Redneck is only open carried in limited circumstances, while honing competence through target practice and buddy team drills. but the group's involvement with firearms has opened a dialogue with right-wing militia groups. And that's kind of the point. Based on a reverence for the Second Amendment, and limited government patriot militias have styled themselves as the contemporary equivalent of the original American revolutionaries. The movement draws heavily from military veterans who are well-versed in handling of firearms. Right-wing militia members frequently espouse a working-class brand of libertarianism, self-sufficiency, that denies the authority of federal agencies. This was on display in April of 2014, when patriot militias in southern Nevada engaged in an armed standoff with federal authorities to prevent the impounding of a rancher Clive Bundy's cattle. Some patriot militia members are also nostalgic for a time when the white Christians held unchallenged dominance in the United States. While gun ownership is embedded in the cultural fabric of the right, the mainstream left greets gun control as something of a civic religion, and that sensibility has only grown over decades of mass shootings, including the most recent Parkland massacre in February. But the American left also has a long history of using guns as tools for self-defense or radical action. The most prominent example is the Black Panther Party, founded in 1966. The Panthers instituted armed community patrols to protect residents from the police in Oakland. The next year, they marched with rifles into the California State House. Even within the Southern Civil Rights Movement, which was grounded in nonviolent resistance, firearms played a role. Most notably, the Deacons for Defense and Justice provided armed security for the March Against Fear across Mississippi in 1966. Redneck Revolt positions itself as an inheritor of these legacies, but its anarchist streak, combined with its effort to court rural white people living paycheck to paycheck, brings it closer to right-wing militias than the Panthers or the Deacons ever would have been. Redneck Revolt has used this proximity for counter-recruitment, trying to shift potential militia members away from right-wing ideology and conspiracy thinkings. When we refer to counter-recruitment, what we mean is that we're working to pull our families and neighbors away from white nationalists and other formations that have threatened our communities, said an unidentified host during a Redneck Revolt podcast in September. Carolina Mountain engagement with the American Pit Vipers heightened during the 4 weeks leading up to the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. To demonstrate good faith, Carolina Mountain members showed up to support a pro-veterans rally organized by the Pit Vipers. The gesture paid off when Chance Allen, another Pit Viper, drafted a statement that disavowed the white supremacist ideology of marquee speakers like Matthew Hemlock and Richard Spencer. Unite the Right does not represent APV, our morals, or our standards, the statement read. APV will not stand in accord with any individual or unit that is in attendance and has openly expressed their support for white nationalists. APV will stand by and support any community in any state that opposes the appearance or existence of white nationalists among them. At a time when liberal commentators are calling for media conversations with hard-hit working-class folks to better understand Trump's populist appeal, Redneck Revolt members have done the work face-to-face, and it's guns and shared gun culture that have brought many people to the picnic table. The Carolina Mountain and Silver Valley chapters, the latter is composed of members from rural Davidson County, Greensboro, and Durham, from North Carolina, provided the backbone of Redneck Revolt's armed presidents in Charlottesville. Members from Pennsylvania and Michigan, along with the Allied Socialist Rifle Association, filled out the ranks. Redneck Revolt members viewed their operation, maintaining a security perimeter around the Justice Park, as support for the larger anti-fascist cause. armed with assault rifles, Redneck Revolt transformed Justice Park into a staging area that allowed Antifa and other militants to confront white supremacists and then return to safety. Members of the Redneck Revolt Network traveled from North Carolina to Charlottesville for extensive meetings with locals in the run-up to August 12th. Redneck Revolt fell into a camp favoring a more militant response, while Black Lives Matter Charlottesville and Standing Up for Racial Justice, a white supremacist group, were part of a coalition that wanted to take a more moderate tack. As recalled by an anonymous member of the Anarchist People of Color in Crimeth Income podcast, a group of us wanted to establish agreement toward a diversity of tactics that respected different tactics such as open carry as a deterrent of violence, anti-fascist blocs, blockading, and basically any tactic that would go toward the goal of defending Charlottesville from fascism. People from SURJ, even people in the newly formed Black Lives Matter chapter, the clergy, liberal groups, progressive groups, resisted that idea and that strategy very strongly, with the feeling that we would get bad press after the fact, that they would be putting people in harm unnecessarily, that people were not consenting to being confrontational. Representative of the less militant faction, not including Black Lives Matter, spent a day with the Silver Valley chapter of Redneck Revolt discussing tactical differences and visiting a gun range. Ultimately, SURJ and Black Lives Matter opted to stage their resistance to the all-right separately from the Redneck Revolt. Walt Heineke, who took out the event permit for the county demonstration in Justice Park, says he wasn't notified of the Redneck Revolt's plan to show up with assault rifles. An associate professor at the University of Virginia, Heineke had hired a local private security firm for the day's event. The security professionals ended up coordinating with Redneck Revolt as the threat of violence escalated. "When I got there, I didn't know who they were," Heineke recalls. "I asked one of my security people. They said they were an anti-racist and pro-Second Amendment militia. They never entered the park. They were on the corner. When I went over to talk to them, they seemed like an affable group of people. They didn't cause any problems." In one of the most tense encounters over the course of the Saturday, Redneck Revolt stood down a column of activists associated with Identity Europa, a white supremacist group. According to Redneck Revolt, members who were present, the Identity Europa members, hesitated when they saw the armed contingent and then walked back in the other direction. "Justice Park was a safe place," Matthew Casilla, a member of the International Socialist Organization, recounted during a tearful speech the following day in Greensboro. "It was under guard by Redneck Revolt, who repeatedly kept the fascists at bay each time they came and marched around the square to intimidate us." From their vantage point, Redneck Revolt members warily observed suspected white terrorists circling Justice Park in vehicles. One of the drivers, it turned out, was James Alex Fields Jr., who had rallied with the white supremacist group Vanguard America. Shortly after encountering Redneck Revolt, Fields drove his Dodge Challenger into a crowd of anti-racist marchers three blocks away, killing Heather Heyer and injuring 19 others. In a later Facebook post, Dwayne Dixon, an assistant professor at UNC's Global Asian Studies Department, boasted of chasing Fields from Justice Park. Dixon gained local notoriety the following Friday when he showed up at an anti-racist rally in Durham bearing an assault rifle. He was arrested 9 days later, but the charges against him were dropped in February. Dixon is part of the Redneck faction that declined to cooperate with this story. While overt white supremacists look for opportunities to attack Justice Park, right-wing militia members equipped with assault rifles roam the streets of Charlottesville and interpose themselves between the alt-right gladiators and anti-racist counter-protesters at Emancipation Park. Redneck Revolt maintained radio communication with the American Pit Vipers, according to a recent Facebook post by AP member Chance Allen. Whether through APV or other sources, Redneck Revolt's plan to show up in Charlottesville were well known within the Patriot movement days before the events. Francis Mann, who was active with American Freedom Militia Keepers, broadcast a Facebook Live video on August the 9th directed to Redneck Revolt, Antifa, and Black Lives Matters, as well as to right-wing militia allies. Without explicitly disavowing white nationalism, Marion staked a neutral position while recognizing the legitimacy of the anti-racist groups on the left. "We've been told that Redneck Revolt has reported that they are taking the same stance," Marion said. "They're providing First Amendment security for folks on that side that are holding the event, that are holding their event in the parks. So an Antifa's holding an event and Redneck Revolt is providing security. Their position is the same as ours as far as protecting free speech without violence, and that is our intent." While Redneck Revolt's armed presence and dialogue with Patriot militias likely prevented further violence, the armed anti-racist group was not welcomed by official Charlottesville. The city, along with the neighborhood associates and local businesses, filed suit against the Redneck Revolt, along with a collection of white nationalists and Patriot militia groups. The suit charges that private military forces transformed an idyllic college town into a virtual combat zone. Despite its tactical differences with the Redneck Revolt, SURJ condemned the lawsuit, charging that it echoes the both sides argument infamously voiced by President Trump. When the guy having ordered its police to stand down, groups like Redneck Revolt and SRA were the last line of defense for the alt-right's planned violence, SURJ Charlottesville posted on its Facebook page on March 30th. Now, instead of taking responsibility for permitting the white supremacists to hide their hate behind the First Amendment, the city of Charlottesville and several local businesses and neighborhood associates have filed this lawsuit attempting to shift blame and perpetrate the both sides narrative, suggesting that leftist groups are just as blameworthy as the white supremacists they helped us defend against. While an independent review by the Charlottesville law firm Hutton & Williams concluded that law enforcement failed to maintain order and protect citizens from harm, injury, and death, contributing to a deep distrust of government within this community, for many on the far left, Redneck Revolt's stand vindicated military anti-fascism. By all indications, Charlottesville broke the momentum of the alt-right. In Knoxville, Tennessee, on the day of the second inaugural Women's March, the avowed fascist traditionalist worker party drew only 20 people, compared to 14,000 people who turned out to protest the Trump administration. Meanwhile, celebrity white nationalist Richard Spencer complained that his provocative campus appearances, which have faced relentless harassment from anarchists, are no fun anymore. The militant left's forceful response in Charlottesville raised the stakes for the alt-right. Notably, the Neo-Confederate League of the South began to shy away from street battles with the far left after Charlottesville. But Redneck Revolt may have inadvertently rewritten the rules for future engagements. After Charlottesville, the League of the South decided, "We weren't going to participate in any further disarmed rallies," Brad Griffin, the league's chief propagandist, wrote on his Occidental Dissent website. "We're always going to be as armed as Redneck Revolt at all of our future events." Charlottesville also created repercussions for Redneck Revolt. The Carolina Mountain chapter withdrew from the national network in January, according to two sources. The split arose because of troubling conduct by one Redneck Revolt member in Charlottesville, his treatment of other members, and ultimately his unwillingness to take responsibility for his behavior. The departed Carolina Mountain and Rose City chapters were not outliers In March, the Shelby, North Carolina chapter also dissociated from the national network, renaming itself the Carolina Workers Collective. In a Facebook post, the Shelby chapter accused the network of perpetuating oppression to the detriment of women, people of color, LGBTQ people, and differently abled members. Carolina Mountain has discounted the counter-recruitment work initiated with American Pit Vipers after concluding that it required too much time and energy and that ultimately the chapter's first priority was building strong relationships with marginalized communities on the left. Members view the work of the Pit Vipers as valuable in the contest of preparing for Charlottesville, but the circumstances of the relationship were so unique that it would be impossible to use it as a model for future organizing. Clarice Allen remains friendly with the Carolina Mountain members, but Silver Valley, the only North Carolina chapter that has remained with Redneck Revolt, has picked up the baton to continue the counter-recruitment work. Since the carnage at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, the armed anti-racists, molded by their experience in Redneck Revolt, have grappled with the implications of the progressive ardor for gun control. Among both loyalists and breakaway chapters, many members resist the idea of disarming their police violence, disarming while police violence goes unchecked, while respecting the agency of high school students demanding change. Pro-gun anti-racists also argue that white supremacy and toxic masculinity are more proximate causes for gun violence than are firearms. Redneck Revolt's sudden rise coincided with the election of Donald Trump. But in the second year of his presidency, its internal contradictions have raised marked difficulties. What is the central cultural idea for the network if many of its chapters have discarded the monikers redneck as too problematic? And how does an organization that attracts both anarchists and communists balance autonomy and cohesion? Whatever Redneck Revolt's future, even in the hashtag never again era, its primary legacy may well be a demonstration of armed community defense against fascism for the 21st century. There is a footnote to this article. This story was produced in partnership with the Triad City Beat. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And a reminder that this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.